Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Back to our conversation now about politics in other parts of the country and continuing to ask you about whether you've voted early and what issue was uppermost in your mind. So I'd like to hear from you on that. And remember, a voting early show coming up at 11. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828 on Twitter at Carrie NPR. Our guest now, Philip Chen, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Beloit College and with us from Madison, Wisconsin. Philip, welcome. Good to talk to you again.
Great to be here, Carrie.
Sharon Navarro with us, Professor of Political Science at the University of Texas at San Antonio, with us from San Antonio. Sharon, so glad you could talk to us because I want to hear what's going on with the Texas Senate race. So welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
Hey, Sharon, I hope you heard what Ken Rudin said about early voting. Do a lot of Texans vote early, and might they be voting early with this very competitive Senate race, or are they waiting because the race seems pretty dynamic?
I think they're waiting because the race seems pretty dynamic, particularly now that we have the national news media bringing to light the caravans from Latin America. I think the voter is waiting to see what the Democratic candidates have to say about this new information that's coming to light.
Philip, I know how this works in Wisconsin, in western Wisconsin. Give me a sense overall about how people in Wisconsin are responding to like the opportunity to vote early. Do they take advantage of that?
I think they do. I don't have the numbers in front of me as far as rates of that, but especially, you know, here in Madison, you can vote in the library ahead of time and things like that. So I think it's a convenience that a number of people do take advantage of. Again, I don't have the numbers off the top of my head.
A listener on Twitter says, and I'm going to have to look into this. I just heard Ken's bit on early voting. Your response: early voting doesn't increase turnout despite best intentions behind early voting laws. Roberto, I'm going to find out if that's true. It's same people voting just earlier. Same day registration is more important. We'll tackle that at 11 o'clock. Okay, to some of the issues that voters are thinking about, to Nate in Minneapolis. Hi, Nate.
Hey, how are you?
Hi, Nate. Tell me what you're thinking about and whether you voted early.
Well, I have yet to vote.
Okay.
I was hoping to get on before Ken left, and I'm glad that you called him out on his opinion about voting.
Uh-huh.
My main issue is voter suppression. While it doesn't affect me personally, I can get in line in my neighborhood. If there is a line and vote pretty quickly on election day, I like going on election day personally, but I disagree with Ken. I think there's voter suppression efforts happening all over the country. We've got North Dakota with their voter ID laws now taking effect, which is targeting tribal communities who have government-issued IDs.
Okay.
For some reason won't work.
So voter laws and voter suppression is something that's top of mind. Philip, is that something that you find comes up among voters, and does it tend to trend towards one party or the other?
I think the language around sort of voter suppression tends to trend towards the Democratic Party, whereas the broader theme of election security, when you talk about voter fraud, that tends to trend towards the Republican Party. So when we talk about voter suppression issues, it does tend to be people who are supporting the Democratic Party, because that's where the conversation has gone among elected officials and among party leaders.
Sharon, I see that President Trump is coming to Texas to campaign for Senator Cruz. Does that tell us anything about about the state of that race in your state?
Sure, yes. It says it's a very competitive race. We sort of have a toss-up. If you look at some of the polls, some of them indicate it's still leaning Republican. Some indicate that it is a toss-up. Trump coming to Texas, particularly Houston, where Ted Cruz is from, indicates that this is still a very red state. This is still a very energized Republican state. And having Trump come out to a state where he is 51% favored can only help the Republican ticket in the state of Texas.
So the other indication is, though, that this race is more competitive than it should be, and Ted Cruz needs the president, where, as I think you've just indicated, he's still fairly popular, to drum up some enthusiasm. Is that right?
Yes. Yes, he's still very popular, President Trump, particularly when you think of, in terms of the top issues for Texas. It's the economy. It's immigration. It's a very large state. And when it comes to voters, they are still feeling the effects of the tax cut from Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. And it's fresh in their minds, that money in their pocket. And the classic question of do you believe that you're doing better than you were 2 years ago? And if you do, let's stay the course. That can only help Ted Cruz. Now, Ted Cruz has the base support of the traditional conservative family values that Texas upholds and constantly gets polled in a positive light in Texas, whereas Beto O'Rourke is a young progressive and has the voting attention of 18 to 35 that rarely come out and vote. So it still leans Republican. It can only help Ted Cruz as we near the end of the race.
Got it. I'll come back to you on the immigration and the migrant issue, because you've mentioned that. But, Philip, in Wisconsin, I know there's a big debate about jobs and Scott Walker's record on that. How is the economy being kind of infused into the way people are thinking about the midterm election?
Right. I think what you see in a lot of the advertisements that both Walker and Evers are running is to talk about where Wisconsin has come and moved since Walker took office. And so the conversation has been around whether there are going to be new taxes, new economic growth opportunities, whether the Foxconn deal, for example, that's
right,
going in around Milwaukee. How do these influence the economy? So, I mean, again, we know this. The economy tends to be one of the number one issues for voters. And so it's really a matter of framing is what we're seeing, is how has Wisconsin's economy been framed? Is it a frame of has Walker done enough versus what will sort of an unknown in Tony Evers do for to the economy? How will he influence the economy? So I think it's really more of a framing issue in Wisconsin as to how the economy is being presented.
And Philip, this is interesting because weeks ago, Scott Walker was talking about this blue wave. And if we don't turn out Republicans, we're going to confront the blue wave. When President Trump says things like pretend I'm on the ballot, does that work in a state like Wisconsin, which has a pretty different political temperature or climate than Sharon Navarro's state of mm-hmm. Texas?
You know, it's tricky because if it works, if that message gets to Republicans, it might work. If that message gets to Democrats, it might backfire. This is again, like what we see today in politics is often an elite driven, a head of the party driven. So a Donald Trump driven vote. And so the question, of course, is if Republicans behave as Donald Trump says and Democrats perhaps behave like a midterm election, then that's good news for Scott Walker. But if we see this kind of reactionary Democratic vote against and a sitting president, which mm-hmm. is often what we see in midterm elections as a referendum on the president, that kind of messaging, that kind of attitude might actually backfire.
Yeah, Sharon, this is really interesting the way this plays, because publicly the president is saying, pretend I'm on the ballot. I mean, we've seen him at rallies doing that. Behind the scenes, there is reporting that he's seeing some of the polling and he's telling confidants and other political observers that yet he's done everything he can, and if they can't win their races, it's not his fault. How do you square the two?
I think it's just the incumbent upon the candidates in states to actually run through the finish line. And I think to some extent he is correct. Presidents can only do so much. And in Texas, Barack Obama had an opportunity to come and endorse one of the state senators, Beto O'Rourke, but he chose not to. And in Texas, that really doesn't matter so much when you are so in love with the Republican state. In this particular state, we are a non-voter engaged state. So it is a Republican state by default because voters are not engaged. And
wow.
The Republican Party doesn't really have to engage the voters. So in a state like Texas that's very large, has a number of electoral votes, it really doesn't matter that much in terms of midterm election because we have voted Republican for the last 20 years.
Interesting.
So it's really incumbent upon the Democrats about what they need to go to energize the base or new voters or independent voters or inconsistent voters to get out and vote.
So just so people understand, you're saying when you say it's a non-voter engaged state, you really just mean there's a lot of people who aren't registered and don't turn out to vote. And many of them are voters of color, and many of them presumably would be Democrats, but they don't vote.
Well, it's not only that. It's just people that typically you don't have to be of either minority. You just are not engaged in voting. We have had, in the last primary election, we had statewide officials from the Republican Party that ran statewide races on social media, didn't hold any town hall meetings.
Oh, my gosh.
And still won. So this is a state where whoever wins based on the individuals who are truly interested in politics. So essentially, as long as Republicans stay the course and not have any scandals or political gaffes, they'll win.
Yeah. Yeah. If you just tuned into our conversation, continuing our talks here on Monday about politics and talking with two guests, two political scientists who are, I am happy to say, outside of the Beltway, Sharon Navarro with us, a political scientist at the University of Texas at San Antonio, and Philip Chen, assistant professor of political science at Beloit College in Madison, Wisconsin. I'm asking them for their take on the political landscape in their states and nationally, and I'm asking you this morning about which issue really rises to the top for you, particularly if you've already voted or you plan to vote early or you're waiting until Election Day. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828 on Twitter at CarrieNPR. To Kevin in Fulda. Hey, Kevin, thanks so much for waiting and good to have you on the line. What are you thinking about?
Well, I'm thinking about the election. Also, I heard your comments on early voting and I just wanted to put my two cents in.
Sure.
I'm one of 500,000 Minnesotans that goes deer hunting. And so I'll be 350 miles from my precinct.
Okay.
And so I need to do it. Even though I personally would like to wait till the last minute, I'm going to be taking care of that shortly.
What will be top of mind when you do it?
For me, you're asking me to choose amongst my children here, mm-hmm. but the environment, it's a very long view thing. I'm very concerned about the lack of concern on the Republican Party, and it makes me feel like if they can't get it right here and if they refuse to believe the science, what do they get it right on? And it looks to me like a short-sighted party, not a long-view party. So that concerns me, and very much I guess I'm a tree hugger, and I'd like to make sure that we get on a course again where we're helping to lead this fight.
All right. Kevin, thanks so much for the call and good luck out there on the deer hunt in a few weeks. To Lori in Itasca State Park. Hey, Lori. Hi.
Hi. And I'm not in Itasca. I'm just near Itasca. I wish I was in it.
Good to know. Beautiful area, isn't it? What are you thinking about as far as issues that rise to the top for you?
I guess I'm very concerned about the number of legislators who reject or minimize climate science and the human impact on global warming.
Yep.
I think there's a real urgency to this issue and to have legislators who are still in denial on this or not accepting the science that is out there is dangerous for everyone.
All right, Lori, I appreciate the call. So, Sharon and Philip, I'm curious about what you hear in that and whether you would find voters in your respective states putting climate and the environment number one on their list. Sharon, what do you think?
In Texas, it's ranked about number eight in terms of issues. I think right now in Texas, the primary issue that's polling high is immigration. And now that we have the media bringing to light the caravans, that is the number one issue on people's minds right now.
Philip, how about in Wisconsin when it comes to climate and the environment?
I would think that what you're going to see in Wisconsin is actually very similar to what you see in Minnesota, is that people who care about the environment, people who see this as an important issue, are likely to be Democratic supporters. Again, we have a similar kind of outdoor heritage here in Wisconsin that Minnesota has. And so you don't have, you know, again, it has tended to be a fairly partisan issue at this point. If you're concerned about climate science, if you're concerned about climate change, you tend to be a supporter of the Democratic Party. And so, again, it's definitely a block of voters. I think you're going to see some people who tend to support the Democratic Party because of climate science. And but I think you tend to not see it's not a balanced issue in that sense.
Somewhat of a niche kind of voter.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think you have pockets of people who care about it. And that's important. I think lots of people have individual issues that motivate them. We know that's the case, that people have certain reasons that they feel attracted to one of the parties. And so in that sense, it's a useful issue for people who are who raise this concern to attach themselves to one of the parties.
So, Sharon, I want to understand, when you say Texans are concerned about immigration and what's happening with this group of migrant people that are coming up from Central America, tell me the different aspects of that, because I think many people in the agricultural sector of Texas know that they need the help and work of people that are coming in from other countries, whether they are documented or not. Give me some of the nuance about how Texans see this.
It's a double-edged sword. We are a border state. Our economies are entwined. Mexico is one of our biggest importers. We share a 2,500-mile border with Mexico, and it falls along party lines. If you're a Democrat, then you believe that immigrants should be protected and we should help them. We shouldn't separate them from the parents and children. If you're a Republican, then you want to draw a hard line on allowing people to come in legally. Yes, we have an agricultural aspect to it, but at this point, they're sort of in the background because they want to let the parties play it out for the voters.
Wait a minute. When you said, what's in the background?
The issue of having immigrants coming over and taking jobs or doing jobs that Texans don't want. That's not what voters want to hear. That's not what politicians want to tell the voters at this point. Right now, what's on the mind is, who is going to stop that caravan? Are we going to end up separating families like we have in the past, which was highly controversial here in Texas because we're so close to the border?
Philip, I wanted to talk about that. It seems like when the news is about child separation, that does not reflect well on Republican policy on immigration. When the news is about a group of people coming up from Central America and they're trying to get into the country, that plays to Republican strength. And I'd love your insight on that.
Again, so this falls along party lines. Oh, I'm sorry.
Sharon, feel free, and then I can hear from Philip on that. Go ahead.
At least in Texas, this falls along party lines. If you're a Democrat, you're for immigration. If you're a Republican, you want to hold that line. But in that, you have some groups, some pockets, as has been mentioned before, that feel, that we should not be so harsh with the immigrants in the Democratic Party as we do in the Republican Party. But there is a huge immigration problem here as seen by a lot of the Republican voters.
Okay. Philip?
I think Sharon hits the nail on the head. It's about partisanship, right? It's about that partisan frame that's put on this. And so in the sense that, you know, when I was talking about climate change, that tends to be a sort of a Democratic issue. Immigration is one of those issues that crosses across both parties, but it's about how it's framed. So exactly like Sharon said, like you were saying, Carrie, when it is about family separation, that's a frame that the Democrats want to put on this, that it's about compassion, that it's about humanitarianism. And when it's talking about sort of a caravan or illegal immigration, that's a sort of a crime and law and order frame, which has historically been a strength of the Republican Party. So it's about what political scientists often call issue ownership, or these sort of the key issues, the best issues for a given party. It's about the frames that are put on it in that sense. So I think that's why you see when they're talking about immigration and the idea of illegal immigration, that immediately cues ideas about the framing and the phrasing of that cues ideas about law and order, about crime that have historically been a strength of the Republican Party. When you talk about family separation, when you talk about the need to keep families together, to act in a sort of a human rights or humanitarian way, that has tended to be an issue or a frame that helps the Democratic Party. And so, again, part of it is that the frames are put on there by elites, by the media, to help that sort of fit into these narratives.
That's right. But it drives the storyline, right?
Exactly, yeah. Right. But it's also partially that voters themselves put frames on these issues, and so. If you're talking about a caravan of Central American migrants, you might say that they're coming here to cross the border illegally, and you might say, well, they're coming here to escape violence and hardship at home. Those are the same group of people, the same issue,
exactly.
Framed in very different ways.
Yeah. You know, Sharon, it's part of the reason I think it's hard to talk about it. And I don't want to say that we endeavor to talk about it in a neutral way, but I really hear what Philip is saying, because many things can be true at the same time on a really polarizing issue like immigration. And it's so highly political. I mean, you know, where do voters end up when they hear these competing messages from the candidates on this?
It's difficult because he is right. It's about priming. It's about playing into the stereotypes of voters. So in some cases, it's playing into the fears of what we think is going to happen but is not really going to happen.
Right.
And so the voter is left up to whatever the media projects, and right, and whatever plays into the comfort zone of the stereotypes of the individuals. So it's whoever gets the message across the better to the voters. In Texas, you know, I always tell my students, you know, truth is, you know, very hard to find in politics because it's all about framing. It's playing into the stereotypes and who does it the best. And for the voters, there's a bit of confusion. When you look at the voting in Texas, there are some conservative Democrats who understand that immigration is a humanitarian issue, but they also have the fear factor of, okay, are we going to pay for it in terms of healthcare? And perhaps this is creeping into why we have such high healthcare costs.
Right.
And in the Republicans, you know, it's these illegal crimes, and this is going to add to the healthcare costs, which are also huge issues to the voters in Texas.
Dean called to say from Hopkins, I'm concerned about the misinformation being provided by politicians. And Dean, I think you've just heard our guests say it's good to be on the alert for that. Specifically, open borders, that's not an issue. No politician supports open borders. Philip, that is a great example of what you and Sharon have just talked about. No one, I don't care what party you're part of, says, let's have no limits, let's just open the borders. But you hear that in the political rhetoric when it comes to immigration debates.
Absolutely. And I think that's intentional it's an effective campaign strategy, right? You can repeat a phrase, and the phrase itself takes on some kind of meaning, right? And so the Republican Party is often framed. It's an easy catchphrase to talk about Democratic immigration policy as open borders. It's a catchy phrase. It's quick to say, and so it provides that kind of elite leadership on the issue of immigration in a way that can be sort of easily digested. But Dean's right. No politician is talking about this concept of open borders. We aren't. That's not part of the conversation. Except that it's a useful catchphrase, a useful frame for the Republican Party to put on the Democratic Party's immigration policies.
Marianne says on Twitter, the current wave of immigrants is very much tied to U.S. policies. Years ago, when the U.S. insists on human rights in Central America, migration goes down. When U.S. funds military ops and supports local intimidation, migration goes up. To the phones to Chris in Hoyt Lakes. Hi, Chris. Are you voting early?
Yes, I will be. I'll be voting this week.
What's on your mind?
Well, deer hunting's why I'm voting early, but PolyMed is my main issue.
Excellent.
PolyMed is my main issue. We've been dealing with this for 14 years. We've passed every permit, done everything the state's required, and the Democrats, for a whole, are still trying to stop the project. The first thing they say is they call it sulfate mining. It isn't sulfate mining. It's very low sulfide-containing
Chris,
ore,
if I might,
proper nickel mining.
I'm interested to hear that PolyMed is a driver for you. Is that primary on your mind when you go to vote this week?
Yes, it's going to be. That and the Kavanaugh issue are my two main issues.
Tell
the way they treated that man on TV was an absolute shame.
I'm glad you brought that up. You know, Philip and Sharon, I haven't seen Kavanaugh pop up until we took this call from Chris. And in some ways, that seems like eons ago, Philip. I mean, do you think it's going to be influential in the way people vote 2 weeks from now?
You know, these are always difficult things because we live in obviously a constant media cycle where everything is, there's always a new issue that pops up. It's hard to say whether people will say, you know, I'm voting because of the Kavanaugh hearings. I'm hesitant to say whether that will be a major issue. So much as I think the extent to which these events, these major political events, are ingrained in our minds is deeply, deeply tied to our existing partisanship, and so. In some sense, the Kavanaugh hearings may have energized people on both sides, and they may not say, I'm voting because of the Kavanaugh hearings, or they may say that, but it likely was a reinforcement of existing partisan beliefs in many ways.
Makes sense. To the phones here to Casey in St. Cloud. Casey, it sounds like Kavanaugh is one of the issues that you'll be thinking about. Are you voting early?
I'm actually going to be voting on Election Day. I grew up in a very Republican household, but I'm going to vote Democrat this year because what I see is the GOP ignoring the right thing to do whatever it takes to keep in power in regard to ramming through Kavanaugh, in regards to climate change, in regards to the voter suppression that's going on all over the country, and a myriad of other reasons.
Good to have your call. Sharon, what are you hearing what Casey's saying there, particularly about Kavanaugh, and then given what Philip just described?
In regards to Kavanaugh, I think he's correct. Voters operate on short-term memory, so whatever the media can frame as the most important issue sets the agenda, say, for the next 24 hours. So it may have energized some pockets of the Democratic Party and the Republican Party, but it's difficult to say whether or not it'll actually increase or have any bearing on voter turnout. In terms of the Republican Party or the Democratic Party not doing the right thing. In some cases, you know, it's their own representative that they, early on they haven't done the right thing. But when it comes up to voting, it's not their candidate that hasn't done what they needed to do in office. So we want to keep that candidate or elected official in office. It's not my guy when it comes to voting on election day. So it's hard to say. We have some energized pockets in Texas. The field Republicans haven't done as much as they should, or Democrats haven't done. But in reality, it's never their own representative when they go to the voting booth.
Yeah. Sharon, just a note here. We have talked about the media's role in elevating particular issues and then moving on. And I do despair of the breathless 24-hour news cycle, which isn't even 24 hours now. But I also want to say there's a lot of voter information out there in the media to be had for people who want to be well-informed to vote. I think mostly when we talk about how the media drives us, we're talking cable news. But I'd be interested in your view.
Sure. I think there is always a sector of the voter that if they're interested in politics, they're going to go out and find the information and do all the research they can. But there's also that huge pocket of voters who are easily swayable by what they see and what they hear. And I think when you looked at the last presidential elections, we had, 46% of working class voters who may or may have, I don't have the numbers in front of me, gone out and vote with very little knowledge. And I think that plays a huge factor in election turnout, particularly when people claim they don't have time to do the research.
Right.
And when information changes so quickly and is in every venue of social media, sometimes it's just easy to accept what you see.
True.
And run with it.
Hey, Sharon, really a pleasure to have you on the show. Thanks for giving us the view from Texas.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Philip, your thoughts on that? I've got about 90 seconds here.
Yeah, I think what you're right. It's a struggle for the media to deal with this. I think one of the things that I sort of look to is the work of Marcus Pryor. Marcus Pryor has written essentially about how more access to information actually leads to a polarization among the people who are learning about politics.
Wow.
And so the when you give people when you look at things like access to internet, access to local newspapers, as people have more options, people who are interested in politics become more engaged and people who are less interested in politics become less engaged. There's less sort of accidental or sort of spillover of information to people who are less engaged. And so what we also know is engaged people tend to be more partisan, more polarized. So, one of the big issues is, of course, what does access to information do?
Right.
It tends to actually, at least if you believe Pryor, lead to greater information among those who are engaged, less information among those who are unengaged.
Philip, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for the view from Wisconsin.
Great to be
here,
Carrie.
We'll talk again.
This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet Carrie at KERRINPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.